Lisa Island. Is it not starting?
Live from Watford, this is The Late Show with Tony Breslin on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good evening, I'm Tony Breslin and this is my first show on Teachers Talk Radio. Get ready for plenty of discussion and a handful of mistakes. Hope you enjoy it. Do call in, do text, we want to hear from you.
Live from Watford, this is The Late Show with Tony Breslin on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
And for the techies amongst you, that will have made complete sense. The rest of you, I hope you get here. Thank you for joining me this evening. I've got a couple, technology allowing, I've got a couple of great guests lined up. Mick Callanan, teacher of English of legend, but also director of the All World Youth Prize. And I have Dave Miller, established special head of a special school. Dave's a very special educationalist, and he'll be talking to us in the show as well. What I want to explore this evening is to take maybe a slightly richer look at this whole post-lockdown thing. But before I do that, I'm going to introduce myself. I'm hoping that my guests will appear on my screen shortly, and then I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves, and then we have a program. So let's see how it goes. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope that I can fill the gap left by line of duty. That was the first of several bad jokes this evening. Okay, so how do I get to be sitting here? Well, that's, you know, somewhat mysterious, but my background, as you'd expect, is in education. I started teaching in pre-Ofsted times, only just, and in pre-national curriculum times, by 1 year. In fact, I had a PGCE in something called Integrated Humanities, and I taught sociology. A year later with the national curriculum, I might not have got onto a teacher training course, and that might, of course, have saved a lot of people a lot of grief. But I've thoroughly enjoyed myself in any case. I've spent time as a school improvement advisor. I spent time running an educational charity which was called the Citizenship Foundation and is now called Young Citizens. And if your schools are involved with things like Go Givers in the primary phase, or if you're involved with things like the Bar National Mock Trial Competition and the Magistrates Mock Trial Competition in secondary, then you will have had some connection with what is now called Young Citizens. For the last 10 years, I've worked independently with individual schools, with people who want to work in education, producing advisory reports on a range of issues. Probably like the rest of you, last January, I was not looking forward to a particularly eventful year. I was very much looking forward to the year, but of course we've had a very different one. And if you work independently, as some of you will know, you carefully create this jigsaw of work that you that gives you an income. Well, that came crashing to a halt with lockdown, and I actually thought, well, I'm going to do that thing that I've been threatening to do for ages. I'm going to write a book about lockdown and about this experience, because I don't think anyone in education has had anything like this before. You know, it's a system shock that is profound. And you might say, well, that's pretty obvious. I've tried to capture that firstly, in a book called Lessons from Lockdown, which involved conversations with over 100 teachers, support staff, everybody else working in the school setting, parents and pupils. I'm now working on the sequel, the book we never thought we'd need or want, called Bubble Schools. Lessons from Lockdown takes us through the first year, and the Bubble Schools takes us through the current year. And this week, for instance, I'm meeting with focus groups of parents tomorrow evening, internationally based educationalists from all over the world on Wednesday morning. It's hard to find a time that suits all of the world, but we've suited a fair bit of it, we found. And with secondary practitioners on Wednesday afternoon. In the last couple of weeks, we've met with SEND specialists and we've met with primary specialists. So that's kind of what I've been doing. And that's why I have a mild obsession. I've always had an obsession with the future of learning. I've always felt that maybe the stuff that we do really well, but that we could do differently. But it seems to me that systems reproduce themselves, and the education system is, you know, like any other system in that respect. So although we're always dealing with change, not much actually does change. Unless there's a real shock to the system. And so COVID has provided that shock. What I'd like you to think about this evening, to call in on and to talk to us about is for us to think about the following. What can't we wait to get back to? Because we're not quite back there yet. And what can't we wait to leave behind? Because what I want to say, suggest to you is that if we don't leave some of the old pre-lockdown stuff behind, we won't have any space for anything new. I think we need that space. But you might disagree. I think I might have my first caller. So I'm going to... I don't have a name. I just have a code on the screen. Welcome to The Late Show with Tony Breslin on Sunday evening. And I'm hoping that somebody's going to start speaking in a moment. But I did tell you we might not get this all right. HH history, HB history, are you out there? Not yet, it would seem. Okay, right. Okay, we'll see if we can get you on in a moment. I've mentioned that I also have Dave Miller and Mick Callanan out there. I think Tom Rogers might be listening. If you're listening, Tom, I think they were struggling to get in. Maybe we could help them. Okay. Well, that's called radio silence, and I'm sorry about that. But we don't seem to have them at the moment. So looking for callers on lockdown, if you're in special, if you're in secondary, if you work as an independent educator, if you're in the independent sector, then we want your views, because my sense is, and one of the points that I have argued continually, and sorry about the scratched record if you've heard this, but I want to contend that no two children, no two families, and no two schools have had the same lockdown. And that when we listen to media coverage on lockdown, what we find is that it's all been the same for everybody, that it's all been a disaster, that we must get back to where we were as quickly as possible. My sense is that actually, if we settle for just going back to where we were, that won't be good enough. Because actually, where we were trying to deal with all manner of gaps. We were trying to deal with all manner of inequalities around pupil premium, for instance, in England, and you know, the poverty gap and so forth. So if we just go back to where we were, we're kind of going back to those gaps we had beforehand. You might say COVID's made those worse. Undoubtedly, COVID has accentuated many of these issues, but I don't think that it created them. So it seems to me that things, and there may even be some benefit, there may even be some benefit to the visibility that this awful virus has given particular things. I just got a message saying Dave Miller's trying to get in, but isn't getting an answer. So if somebody's out there from Teachers Talk Radio who can help me get Dave through the door and Mick through the door, that would be great. I may not be pressing a button at this end. I need to press connect on screen. I've just had a message. Aha. Well, I'm at the moment not seeing a connect button. Okay, I'll keep watching my screen and edge towards some kind of competence at this. But for instance, in terms of poverty and disadvantage, I want to suggest that I want to suggest that actually what COVID has done is created a new visibility to poverty. For once, we now have a situation where people are beginning to accept that poverty, never an excuse for underachievement, but it might actually be an explanation. And I do think we confuse those words too easily. It seems to me that that is sometimes at the root of some of our issues. It seems to me now that there is a level of agreement. I think we have Mr. Cullinan. Do we have you in the room?
I hope we do, Tony. How's it going?
Very well. Well, that's a relief. We have a guest and we have a show. And I know that Dave Miller is knocking on the door as well. And those of you,
you can't hold a good man down like Dave Miller.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I did say to you that my guests would become bursting through the door, and Mick has, thank you for that.
Pleasure to be here, Tony. And I thought you handled that dead air very well.
Well, yeah. Such is. You often hear, don't you? People have been doing this for years, and they say, "Oh, well, that's the perils of live radio." So I'm not going to get carried away with myself and say
I won't say problem. Never work with animals or children, because none of us would get paid.
Indeed, that's a very good point. Now, there you are. You have the second bad joke of the evening, one for each of us. Doubtless Dave will knock on the door again in a minute. Next time, Dave, you knock on the door, I think I'll know what to do. Mick, why don't you start just by telling us a bit about yourself? I should say it's my first show, and I've called in a couple of people who I've worked with as professionals and I've held as friends for many years. I might get more adventurous in future shows and invite people who I haven't worked with for years. But Mick, tell us about your background, you know, as Cyril would say, what's your name and where'd you come from?
Well, I'm Mick Callanan, and I am a teacher of English. I've been doing it for yonks, longer than I care to admit, really. I've been a head of English a couple of times and an advanced skills teacher. With my other hat on these days, I'm also what they call delivery director at the Orwell Youth Prize. That's a kind of fancy title for somebody who devises and delivers workshops with a writer to get young people to enter the Orwell Youth Prize. And I think we might have a chance for a chat about that later, Tom.
Yeah, we will. Yeah, in the final half hour of the show, we're going to look at that in a little bit of detail, and colleagues might want to get involved. But it's about encouraging young people to produce great writing.
Yeah, to writing that's oriented towards social justice. You know, with the name Orwell attached, you can imagine there's a style element there that it's about clarity and simplicity. A directness, I suppose, that we're inviting. But in terms of subject matter, it's very much about social justice, the kind of things that George Orwell was interested in. But to come back to my sort of big hat as an English teacher, I know that tonight you want to talk about, like the title of your book, Lessons from Lockdown. You know, what are the things that we take away? And I think it would not be an exaggeration to say that my subject, English, is in something of a crisis. Maybe it's a kind of identity crisis. But I think when you're working in a profession which is constantly subject to what I would call political interference, I think there's always going to be, we're always kind of lurching, it seems to me, from one crisis to another. But at the moment, our subject seems to be going downhill in terms of its A-level take-up and what have you. And I think that's got its roots in a not very successful GCSE and everything that flows from that. But I do want to say some positive things very much about, you know, about the things that we've been learning in lockdown and so on.
Well, tell us about those things that you've been learning. And in particular, what I want us to edge towards is a great phrase was given to me the other day in one of my interviews for Bubble Schools with Tracy Middleton, who's a governing body clerk in Hertfordshire. And Tracy clerks for 37 governing bodies. And she said, Tony, what I say to each of my governing bodies is, when we get to AOB, I say to them, so what are your COVID keeps? And I quite like that notion of COVID keeps. In other words, what stuff that we didn't do beforehand that we are doing now, are we going to keep afterwards?
Yeah.
And if that requires some sort of slight, you know, reorganization of how we work and all the rest of it, how are we going to go about that? So, what are your COVID keeps?
Well, let me start with one. One of the things I've really enjoyed of late is online parents' evenings. So, of course, our traditional format is for everybody to come into a big room, the hall with maybe some overflow rooms and what have you, and people queue up. And how successful it is, you know, it depends partly on the individual teachers and our own inclination to think that what we have to say is terribly important and it can't possibly be contained within the 5-minute slot allocated to us. So, and of course, if we go on beyond that slot, it has a knock on for our colleagues around the room. And so things get jumbling. But I do want to defend the parents' evening, because I think it's a great occasion for parents to come to school. And for parents to interact with each other and to actually see teachers in the flesh and so on. So in my mind, it's a great example of what we COVID keep, but with nuance. So I think in the future, the ideal for me would be to alternate year on year between an online parents' evening and an in-person parents' evening as the kids go through the school. Now, the reason for that is you get the kind of benefits of both approaches. The terrific thing about these online parents' evenings is that the bits of software. I can't even remember the name of the one that we're using. Others are available, even if I could. But what you get is a 5-minute slot and a 1-minute breathing space. So the parents and the child usually come in. You've got your slot. You fill it. There's a little countdown timer. You know you're coming out soon. You've got to finish off. And everyone is forced by the technology into the discipline of the thing. So for me, it's worked really. And it's also meant that while I'm looking at parents and a child on screen, I've also got another window open, which has got a record of the children's work, really easily accessible. Sometimes, you know, access to, we use Google Classroom these days at my school. So I'm able to access actual documents in the course of that conversation. Really, I like to bring with me books to a parent's evening. But as you can imagine, it's kind of a bit cumbersome to be pulling them out and what have you, although it sometimes works. And so if you see what I mean, Tone, for me, it's a great example of this nuance that what we keep from COVID isn't going to be all technology is great. We've got to assess each case and think, well, what are the pros and cons? Let's weigh it up.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. And it seems to me that one of the things that's coming across very strongly in the conversations I'm having is that I think if I go back to the interviews and focus groups that I was holding last June, very much, quite a lot of people were kind of saying, it's a bit of a pain that we've got to do this technology stuff and we're not seeing each other and this will never replace the real thing. I don't think anybody is saying even now that it will. But it does seem to me that the future isn't online or offline, it's blended. And one of the things, you know, so you've suggested this idea of a parents' evenings 1 year and online the next and in the room parents' evenings the following year. I mean, the other thing that occurs to me is that what we might find is that we have the online parents' evening as a kind of base offer, but that we make physical contact with those parents where children have particular needs or issues or talents that we want to follow up. So ironically, we might get more deeper one-to-one stuff as a result of having the online stuff. It's not one or the other. Kind of notion that you know, there is there could be an expectation, for instance, that every parent will meet with at least 3 teachers during the course of a year in the secondary setting, as well as the general online parents' evening. It seems to me, if we take ourselves back, certainly if I go back to, well, my own experience of you know, being the teacher side of the desk on parents' evening, in secondary settings, was that there'd be terrific turnout in year 7. It would be down very slightly in year 8. It would sometimes fall off a cliff thereafter. And because some parents, their experience of that evening would be of working their way around several desks in a hall, or worse still, working their way around a building they're unfamiliar with to various rooms and being told in each one that their child's not doing well. And that's a bit disheartening. And as a result, we would say as teachers, we never get to see the parents we need to. I just wonder whether the baseline of an online consultation, which can then, you know, the 5 minutes might conclude with, well, look, we need to have a face-to-face conversation about this. We'll be in touch. And it seems to me that that's a healthier place to get to. I've re-experienced secondary parents' evenings, having been out of the classroom for a little while in the last few years, because both of our boys are now at secondary school. And I think they're ripe for change. And I know how much effort goes into them and how hard teachers try to make them accessible and pleasant and all the rest of it. And I think we've got better as a profession at that. But it does seem to me that I've hardly met anyone who has missed the traditional parent safety. They may have missed the face-to-face consultation with parents, but I'm suggesting we could possibly have both there. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely, Tom. I mean, I think blended is the way.
And that may offer us a COVID keep. Any callers out there with COVID keeps, things that you want to keep live, do let us know. Mick, anything else on the keep front?
Oh, yeah, I've got a couple of things. My favourite bit of technology is this thing called Moat. And like I say, with all of these software examples, there are others. But the one I know is Moat. It's an extension that comes with Google that allows you to record spoken feedback. And I was thinking about why I liked it quite as much as I do. And partly it's because of my own appalling handwriting, which has not improved over the many years of my career. And I've tried to make a virtue of that particular vice by saying to the kids that I teach, look, my handwriting is awful, as I give out a piece of work back to them. My handwriting is awful. You may need to come and check it with me. So when they come and ask me what the words actually say on the page, I read it to them, and there entails a little conversation. So the feedback process actually becomes a bit more active. But what I really liked about this whole thing of recording feedback, I'm not a quick typist. I'm an awful handwriter. I'm sure I'm not alone in that among colleagues out there. But the idea of simply recording 30 seconds or a minute to a child means I get more actual information than I would type up in that time or handwrite in that time. But also that the child gets to feel the personal and emotional quality, which of course is absolutely at the centre of what they want. They wouldn't want to admit it probably, but the child wants to be patted on the back, and he or she wants to be told that they're heading in the right direction, they're doing the right things mainly. What are the areas to focus on for improvement? And I find I can just say that much more quickly and efficiently than I can write it. And then the child can pick up that bit of feedback from Moat whenever they want and act on it, hopefully.
So a popular, and I can see from the text reader here, comments like Moat is brilliant. So clearly you're not alone in that.
Moment. Ah, yeah. Cool.
And give us a third before we go to the news.
My third COVID keep. I suppose one of the things I've really enjoyed about being online is it's kind of liberated again my sort of a bit of an early teacher thing in me, that I liked going out and finding pop music and other pop culture stuff to do with my classes. And I found that it brought that out again in me. So I've been teaching Of Mice and Men, as many English teaching colleagues around the country are, to year nines. And I found a lovely version by George Michael of Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, which is one of these great 1930s Depression era classics of the kind of folk tradition in the States. And I thought, right, I'm going to make the George Michael version of this song part of the learning on Of Mice and Men. And all I was able to click through YouTube, you know, we're all using YouTube, aren't we, these days? Click through, get a little URL from YouTube, I bang it into Google Classroom, I nipped into Wikipedia, which I love and subscribe to. I'm not one of the skeptics that some people are. And Wikipedia had a great article on that song. And within a few minutes, I had set up a lovely little research task on why this song was a great example of the Depression. So it was just, instead of me teaching the kids, right, this, you know, there was the Wall Street crash and blah, 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 1930s poverty. Instead, there was a cultural creative way in to starting that work going. And it's just made so easy by the tech.
Well, that's do you think, Mick, I mean, you know, that's interesting that each of your examples has had a kind of technological dimension to it. Do you think as a profession that we were ready to make this shift anyway, and COVID may have speeded it up a bit? Or do you think this has actually happened because we were stuck in this scenario where we had to embrace the technology? Did you think 9 months ago or 12 months ago, as a profession, that we'd be where we are now with tech?
It's a good one. I'm inclined to say it's a bit of both, but perhaps more the former. I think we were on the way to this, but what COVID has done by pushing us all out of the classroom, it's forced us into thinking in probably a really productive way, I hope a really productive way, about how we use these technologies. So at my place, we were already going to be embracing Google Classrooms. We've now been issued with these Google laptops, which I don't especially love, but it does mean that the school in the future is going over towards a device for every child. And I think that was inevitable.
You're breaking up a bit there, Mick.
COVID. Am I back in the room?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit.
Can you hear me, Tom?
Yeah, just about.
Oh, just about hearing. So what I'm saying is, it forced us to actually think properly about it. So in that sense, it's a good thing.
Okay. Well, with that thought, we'll go to the news, find out what the news agenda is saying for us this week with Tom Hopkins-Burke, who has the education news.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Tom Hopkins-Burke.
This is your weekend Teachers Talk Radio news with Tom Hopkins-Burke. Education Secretary Gavin Williamson has confirmed that secondary school students will no longer have to wear masks in classrooms. The government will remove the measure at stage 3 of its roadmap for exiting lockdown on Monday the 17th of May. Students will still be recommended to wear face coverings when moving around school buildings. Dr. Mary Bowersted, Joint General Secretary of the National Education Union, said that schools should be permitted to retain mask wearing in the classroom if they think it necessary. A Derbyshire secondary school will stay shut until next week after more than 100 pupils and staff tested positive for coronavirus. Wilsthorpe School did not reopen after the bank holiday and will not fully reopen until the 11th of May. Two mobile testing units opened exclusively for staff, pupils and people with a direct link to the school on Thursday. The school has postponed GCSE and A-level assessments for teacher-assessed grades and has moved to remote learning. A police and crime commissioner candidate has apologised for his rant against teachers in a local residents' WhatsApp group. Chris Jones, Liberal Democrat PCC candidate for Cleveland, said that teachers had enough time off and get more holidays than any profession anyway during a discussion about the return to school. He added that the children and their education come first and any unhappy teachers should get a job in construction or something. In a reply to the WhatsApp group, Jones stated, "Lesson learned, don't use social media when in a drink." That's your Teachers Talk Radio news. with Tom Hopkins-Burke.
Live from Watford, this is The Late Show with Tony Breslin on Teachers Talk Radio.
We're talking this evening about all things lockdown, about lessons from lockdown and about COVID keeps. How can we build on the creativity and the innovation of the last 12 months as we've fought to deal with the virus that nobody would have wanted? Are there some positives we can take from it? Could this be a catalyst to help
Live
it out?
Live from Watford, this is The Late Show with Tony Breslin on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Well, I think you know where I was going with that comment before I was knocked down a bit like a charging bus by my own jingle. There you go. Now I know how long 28 seconds is. I did about 14 at the top of the show. Anyway, Nick, we talked about all things technology. We're hoping to get Dave to join us. I'm hoping that that we'll get some call-ins from people. We'd love to hear listeners experiences of all of this. So let us know what's happening for you. One of the things that I do want to ask about, Mick, is this kind of and I'm wondering, just listening to the news there, should we have Chris Jones? He may be a Democrat, but he doesn't sound very liberal to me.
Tony, I can't believe he's having a rant.
Indeed.
Lovely pronunciation there.
Indeed.
Of rant.
but maybe we should have Chris Jones on as a slightly more disagreeable guest in the future. I'm sure he's a thoroughly nice guy, really. And maybe a number of us have said things online that we oughtn't to, but boy, it is a warning, isn't it? Certainly... I mean, my wife's a head teacher. A number of my friends are heads and in senior leadership. And as a group, you know, they have without fail all said this has been the most challenging experience ever of their headship. And many of them have 20 or 30, you know, years in the profession. Now I have somebody here as a speaker. Mick, we have a guest. We'll find out who they are in a moment.
Wonderful.
Hello. Welcome to the show. Who's out there? Ah, I think this is Dave Miller under his new identity and his new enterprise. You can tell us about that in a little while, Dave, but welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Tony. I'm here at last. I've had to come in under a pseudonym, but... I haven't got a problem with that. I've taken some techie advice from someone behind the scenes. Anyway, nice to hear your voice. It sounding good earlier on, and it's obviously I speak to you a bit, but I haven't seen you for a while, Mick. Nice to hear your voice. All the best.
Likewise, Dave. You sound almost musical, if I could say that.
Oh, blimey. You always were like that, weren't you? I'll sing now, a song if you want. Anyway, carry on.
Dave, maybe that's not a good idea. although Dave does front a band, it should be said, or I think several. Anyway, Dave, you know, there was a little piece in the Teachers Talk Radio news there about a local a candidate in the local elections, I think a police commissioner candidate, who said some pretty stereotypical stuff about teachers having too much holidays and they really ought to get a hard-working job, you know, and so forth. As someone married to a head teacher, you know, I think that if I introduced Chris to most of the heads I know, there'd probably be a series of public order incidents that may indeed lead them to leave the profession, but it wouldn't be because they were looking for a harder working job. Tell us about headship during lockdown, but in particular, tell us about yourself and your career and how you've made this move many years ago now. You made the move into special ed. You've worked most of your career in special ed. What drew you in, and what lessons, and I know you won't want to upset our colleagues in mainstream. I don't want to send the viewers down into single figures, but the viewers, the listeners. But tell us about, from the point of view of somebody in special education, the head of a special school. I know how well connected and networked you are with colleagues in alternative provision and so forth. What's lockdown been? Well, what took you into special? What was attractive about it? That's my first question. And so that's the biographical piece, really. And the second is, you know, how have you found all of this? Because I know you've done a piece on ITN News, haven't you? And
we did. Yeah,
you featured strongly in lessons from lockdown with some of your incisive contributions. So, yeah, tell us about.
I started as a primary practitioner and had a great time for a few years, really enjoyed it. But when I was at Newcastle Poly doing my teacher training, there was an SEN course running. I don't know what it's still, I don't think it's still going. And I always thought perhaps I should have been on that side of things, because that was where I found myself most interested in the classroom, with the young people who had the more particular needs. So I got towards acting deputy at a primary school in Watford quite quickly, and then applied for a job with the RNIB in SEN, and took the job, but spiralled back to the very to the bottom of the scale, main scale teacher with no responsibility point or anything. And after about 3 or 4 days, I realised it was by far the best thing I've ever done. So I fell in love with working in SEND very quickly. And the reason was, I suddenly found I was in a class of 8 pupils with 3 support staff, and I felt as though every day that I'd got round all the pupils properly and give them as much of my time as I could and effectively, which I certainly didn't think I was doing in 32 kids in a primary school. So I felt as though very quickly that you had more of a chance of being a success. But then the other thing as well, I just found the kids fascinating. I mean, the range of need and the range of sort of mixture of fantastic determination and very intriguing young people, and then also as well the staff who work in special schools, across the whole board in teaching, you've got great people, you really have. And but I felt as though the staff in special schools, I could relate to them more, and I really respected and enjoyed them very quickly. So luckily, I've long lost contact with my former primary colleagues from 1996, because I might not think I'm likely here saying that, but I have really enjoyed working with SEN staff. And of course, then you realise that I had no intention of moving up the ladder, and then I started getting more and more management experience, and realised I was enjoying working closely with the adults, as I was with the adults being the staff and the pupils. And then realise I could have an impact on both. And so you do. I did NPQH, and as soon as NPQH was out of the way, I'm not sure whether you still can, but in 2005, I think it was when I did it, there was a sort of SEN strand. So once I'd done that, doors started opening. I became a head teacher stroke principal in 2006, I think it was, or 2007. And getting on to my late 50s, the only thing I think about the future is dreading retirement. I don't want to do that just yet. So it's a great place. It's a great sector to work in, and I enjoy every single second. It's a privilege. It's a real privilege.
Dave, that's the kind of head teacher I like to hear. A kind of organic, what I think of as an organic head teacher, somebody who's come through teaching and loving the teaching, and that has grown into management responsibility, or it's grown out of that, rather than somebody, and I'm sure there are strong colleagues in this, but somebody who's set off, as it were, to do management, and it happens to That's be right. teaching that they're doing it in.
Yeah, I spent 8 or 9 years mainly on the floor of a classroom working with young people with profound disabilities. And then, you know, I wasn't lying on the floor of the classroom. I was walking and enjoying the environment with these kids. Had a fantastic time. And then management didn't really feel like the right thing there. And it was, yeah, it wasn't that fast track. It was definitely, I'll have a go at this. And then realised you could have an impact on both. And when I was leaving that school to go into a headship, my own headship, a chap who was doing cover, he was covering as an acting head at the time, like sort of a supply, consultant head, that's right. Very, very, a brilliant man. Still recognise him as one of my educational heroes, Chris Benton, while he's out there, but what a man. And he said to me, before I went, he said, look after your staff. And I said, well, hang on a minute. No, that's all about the kids. You know, it's all about the kids. And then he quickly realised when you're ahead that doing both is a very, very important part of the job. And I'm not going to jump the end yet, Tony, but obviously that's where one of my COVID keeps comes in. Right.
Well, that's great. And I mean, actually, your point about looking after staff is so vital, isn't it? I was, I think you might have been in the group, Dave. You were certainly in one of the groups. We held a couple of focus groups with American school principals.
Yeah,
because that's one of the wonders of this technology. And we had a group of American school principals and aspirant principals who were all studying at the University of Texas at San Diego. And I remember a New York high school principal who, when asked what was the one thing that he'd changed his mind on through this, he said, I used to think it was all about the children. And there was a bit of a sort of slightly awkward pause in the room, because kind of what the rest of us sort of said was, well, it is, isn't it? But he said, I used to think it was all about the children, but now I've realised that I've got to put my teachers first. And the reason I've got to put my staff first, the reason I've got to put my staff first is that if I don't look after my staff, they won't be able to put the children first. And I think that's really interesting. And I have a similar conversation with school governors. I do a lot of work. I'm a chair of a governing body, and I do a lot of work training school governors. You know, one of the things that has changed in terms of head-governor relationship through this has been that support and challenge thing, where we've kind of moved firmly to the support end of that continuum, because we have needed to during this period. And I keep saying to people, you know, are you giving your senior leaders the support they need? Because if you don't, they won't be able to give the support to their teachers. And if they can't do that, then their children will be the will be the losers in that. So, of course, what our American principal and what you've just said, or rather what your mentor said, Dave, you know, really important to remember the importance that we have to support and nurture our staff, and never more than at the moment. But that's a hell of a responsibility, isn't it?
Well, it's a good point. And you know, sitting here saying that, I don't feel as though I could go into school tomorrow and guarantee that every single member of my staff, and there's about 70 of us in the school, there's only 140 pupils, there's about 70 staff, could walk up and go, Dave, you know, you absolutely do your best for us. And so the point I'm making is the COVID keep we're talking about is not just recognising that good and high quality support for staff is vital, but getting it right isn't easy, and getting and working out how to do it is a legacy from this. I think I've got a colleague in books who's been promoting staff mental health. In fact, she created a website around Buckinghamshire with a lot of resources on. Brilliant piece of work. And so recognising that the mental health and the staff welfare and all the things that come with it is so, so important. But getting it right is, we're a long way off that at the moment, I think. But at least it's risen more to the fore. I'd like to think that throughout my careers ahead, I've had a thought towards it and actions towards it, but I think I've still got a lot to learn myself, and so have a range of head teachers. So I wouldn't say it's on the starting blocks, but it's not down the bottom end of the towards the finishing line yet. There's a fair way to go.
I think also that, and I don't know if you've got views on this, Mick, as well, but I think also what we've begun to break away from in I think over the past year is some of the false choices. So that, you know, what one used to say, look, well-being's a nice to have, but actually, you know, we're focused on achievement, we're focused on attainment, we're here for the children, that's what matters. As if that's some kind of false alternative. It seems to me that if we fail to understand that well-being for our teachers, the inclusion of our children, are not alternatives to attainment and success, they are the prerequisites for it. And they're absolutely prerequisites for children who have greater difficulties, for staff who may be going through issues or whatever. So they're getting away from that notion that stuff on the kind of inclusion side of the achievement inclusion nexus or the attainment well-being nexus are kind of also-rans, are kind of nice if you can. I'm beginning to think we're beginning to recognise that if we put some of this stuff first, the well-being, the inclusion, etc., it will pay us back in spades. Not least in, I think, and I don't know whether from, you know, one of you's ahead and one of you's not ahead, so be interesting to get both sides on this and from our listeners as well. But my sense is that one of the things that's happened during COVID is a kind of rise of some new empathies. So I think, for instance, there are some new empathies between parents and teachers.
Yeah.
On both sides. We've been peering through Zoom screens into each other's rooms. In some settings, we've been delivering food parcels, et cetera, et cetera. So there's new empathies arising there. But there's new empathies, I think, between staff and leaders. I think actually a number of staff have recognised the level of responsibility that rests on the shoulders of senior leaders, especially heads. But am I just wishful thinking there? Are we a bit more empathetic on various scales?
Definitely. Looking at the staff head or SLT and head relationship with staff, I think there's people have been kind enough to say, you know, I realise how busy you are and the responsibilities, and also people have been kind enough to just tap you on the shoulder and just say, by the way, are you all right? And that's brilliant. So, yeah, I definitely think it's brought that together. And of course, the whole thing from last March onwards has been a team effort, uniting the team. You know, it really has. So, and recognising the importance of the role we all play. But it has been, it has been valuable, but also really very enjoyable, if you like, for a head teacher in certain aspects because of the challenges.
Yeah, I think, Dave, Tony, that this assessment period is something that we're going to be looking back on and thinking about, I reckon, over the next couple of years from a lot of different angles, but one, it will be very much from this, what sort of relationship, what sort of tone has SLT created with middle managers and teachers. Certainly where I am, it's a very supportive setup, I think, in both directions. People do acknowledge the scale of the challenge that school leadership teams are going through in making these decisions about how are we going to assess, how many assessments, what period are they going to be taken over, in what circumstances, how are we going to work with departments to acknowledge their expertise but create consistency between different subjects across the school. All of these kind of complex decisions which have been made very last minute, and that's not the fault of any teacher, I think those decisions and those processes have really put into sharp relief the kind of relationships. And I think, I feel like, Tony, you were saying, I feel quite optimistic about that, that there is a greater empathy going between SLT and the teaching body as a whole.
And there absolutely should be, Mick, as well. And there, and it is improving. Mm. And it is one of the outcomes, legacy of what we've all just been through for the past 15 months. Totally agree with that.
I think we're developing a greater emotional literacy in schools. And I think the sense of children's emotional well-being and their mental health is something that is seen in relationship to teachers. You know, are we grounded? Are we happy? Are we able to do the job? That's one of the crucial questions that schools need to ask and increasingly are asking. I mean, I know some institutions that I think burn teachers out, more or less as a kind of unintended policy of the way they go about recruitment, the way that orders are handed down about the way results must be achieved at all costs. But I think they are thankfully in a minority and probably dwindling.
Yeah.
It's worth saying, isn't it, Mick, that you are at a high achieving school. That one of the reasons parents choose it is because the young people achieve great results. So I think what we've got to get away from is that the only way you can deliver great results is by this kind of, this pressure cooker approach. I certainly feel that people have come away from that a bit.
You've got to, as you know, Tony, I'm not one for... huge one for going back into research and all sorts now, or however have been, really. But I stumbled across and then met someone called Mary Myatt. I don't know whether you're aware of Mary Myatt, but she's written a book called High Challenge, Low Threat. And that's what it is. Of course you want a high challenge for the pupils, but you don't want the teachers threatened. So a place which is struggling, which is high challenge, high threat, disaster,
I've got to say, Dave,
disaster coming along.
In an interview situation a few years back for an SLT member that I was involved in, I put the question, what's more important, a child going up from a C to a B, or their mental health being protected for the GCSE course? And I was absolutely astounded. Colleague couldn't deal with the question. And the answer is, it should be, in my view, really straightforward, that you can have those high aspirations, but you find ways of not making young people feel absolutely desperate.
Yeah.
And if you become aware of children and young people, you have the processes to get them out of that.
And that's exactly the same for the staff. They need to be... challenge to perform high, challenge to get the best for the pupils, but they're really unsupported, and that's where your low threat comes in. I mean, performance related pay is a disgrace to me. It's the worst idea I feel as of a teaching, but, and that's why I've never used it in my schools, but you still need to be supported and enabled and obviously challenged as well.
Yeah. But again, isn't there, to go back to your interview question, Mick, in a sense, the response to that surely should have been that it's a false choice. That actually, although it's counterintuitive, that child may well have a much better chance of getting a B rather than a C if they're happy, contented, if their well-being is attended to. Yeah. And that it's about coming away from those false trade-offs. And I think sometimes choosing to play a longer game where inclusion and well-being come first and attainment flows from it. And you know that, but that's probably for another show. and we could certainly talk more about that. Dave, I just wanted to ask you one thing about special ed to start with. One of the observations that I've been making that has come back to me from various teachers, various heads, haven't done a detailed survey on it or anything like that. So I can't suggest this is conclusively the case. But I am inclined to think that when all the anecdotal evidence points in the same direction, there may be something in it. And the something in it is this, that one of the unexpected outcomes of the second lockdown as opposed to the first, because I think with the first we were struggling with a lot of this still, is that in the second lockdown, quite a lot of those so-called vulnerable children, and I hate the term, but those children found themselves in school, more so than in the first lockdown. They found themselves in school and they found themselves in the small groups that they'd always wanted to be in. And they found themselves making more progress than they did in ordinary circumstances. Mm-hmm. Now, is there any, and therefore what I'm kind of, bit of background noise there. What I'm kind of asking is there something to learn from SEND methodologies in this regard that actually we have got to work with some of those children that previously we might have defined as hard to reach and not reached out to them. And therefore, is there stuff we can, I'm bridging across to the COVID keeps thing, but is there on the one hand stuff we can learn from SEND colleagues on that? And on the other, is there something about the perennial question of teaching groups and giving children enough personal bespoke attention?
I think it's important to say, you just said about those hard-to-reach kids, I feel as though COVID has brought the, for want of a better phrase, easy-to-reach kids. You know, those kids that are doing all right, and there's a lot of them. You're doing all right, there are no issues. Actually, COVID's brought out the fact that these so-called easy-to-reach kids actually do have an awful lot of things you should be finding more out, about.
Yeah.
And obviously, and that will lead to improvement in so many ways, not just social, emotional, mental health, but certainly attainment as well. So special schools, there's a simple mathematical fact that makes special schools more able to reach kids in that way and reach the different needs is because, as I mentioned before, there's 140 pupils in our school and 70 staff. It's a simple mathematical fact. We've got more bodies around less kids. So personalisation, individuality, understanding need is a stamp. It's a trademark of the SEN department schools. Has been for years. Probably one of the things I've liked about it. And I've got to say, I cannot, there's so many, our kids are different. I'd love to be able to genuinely say, of the 140, we meet 140 different needs. We don't. We do have to a bit of sharing around a bit. But that ethos and that approach to education where you can hone in on all sorts of elements of that young person and support them as individually as you can. I don't blame secondary school, big secondary schools or big mainstream primaries or even small mainstream primaries for having that as a challenge because it's not easy to do. But if having that as more of a principle in the secondary sector or the mainstream primary or the mainstream sector or the mainstream primary, if that awareness of that need has been raised by COVID, then that is a real proper COVID keep. It's a bit of a journey. It's going to take a while, but I would like to think my brother's a secondary school teacher, and I'm pretty sure that at the start of say the summer term, well, let's say the September, he gets his kids. The head of department gives them expected progress, and off they go, and they chuck them in the machine and get on with it. It would be a fantastic legacy of this COVID if we all sides of education try and hone in more on the child. And you mentioned vulnerable children. You know, there's a phrase commonly used in SEND, which is child in need. And does anyone know a child who's not in need, by the way? Every single child has needs. And you've got to find out, and you've got a chance through personalization and individualization to ensure that those needs, you know, that are impacting on them are supported and met. And it could be a very positive thing. You know, I found out things about the kids who were coming in I didn't know. And I've also found some things about them which I need to support and address. So remembering that every child is a child in need and being able to address those needs. It's always been pretty good in the special schools SEND sector. One of my COVID keeps is to make it better, is to ensure it gets better and better and better. And I would respect my colleagues in mainstream to consider that as a way forward for them as well.
Okay, Dave, any other particular keeps that have come to you during this period that we must hold on to?
I got the exam paper off you early, Tony. Thank you. I've been trying to think. I mean, I can't not talk on a station like this and not say it. There's an awful lot of things I cannot wait to get rid of. Like, I really mean it. It's May 2021. So the way my school is at the moment, it's different to May 2019, 2018, 20, and all the years. COVID is causing day-to-day challenges, which I can't wait to see the back of. And that's like, obviously, masks. But I want teachers to be able to go in and set the class up any shape they want, interact how they want, encourage the kids to interact. It's not like that now. And that's putting the pressure on the kids and it's putting the pressure on the teachers as well. So COVID get rid ofs, I'll keep on going. But COVID keeps increasing personalization, individual needs, increasing and developing more skillfully support for staff in every element of their welfare, their job satisfaction, respect. I'd like to think somewhere along the line someone might consider looking at the pay of teaching assistants who a school like ours cannot survive without, yet and deserve to be rewarded better. So if that was a legacy of a great, so COVID keep is definitely an improvement and a development of the things we sort of already knew. And I honestly couldn't say there's anything else that comes to my mind of particular things that would be I'd want to keep. I suppose it's a tenuous way I could say one of the COVID keeps will be the memories, because I've got some great memories of last year. Not so much the January, February term, but some great memories of, you know, suddenly being told to close a school on a Friday and reopen on the Monday and wondering how it's going to look. And these groups, these sort of 15 so kids that came in every single day. We didn't shut from March to July, all the way through Easter and half term we stayed open. And we couldn't get enough of it. It was great. Very, very happy memories. Mm. But other COVID keeps, not many for me, Tony, I'm afraid. Not many for me.
Good stuff. And Mick, anything you've mentioned a few in the first segment of the show. Any further thoughts on this?
One thing that occurs to me, we're going to talk about Orwell.
We're a couple of minutes off it, but it's coming down the line.
It's coming. Yeah. When I came up with what the online equivalent would be of an Orwell Youth Prize workshop this year. I decided to kick it off with a wonder walk. Now, Orwell himself wrote these fantastic essays about all kinds of things, like In Defense of English Cooking. And he wrote about the joy of the toad. So Some Thoughts on the Common Toad is one of his great essays. And it's all about celebrating spring. And it being Orwell, it's inevitably a political piece, because he finishes it by saying, whatever the bureaucrats and the tyrants want to do, they can't stop the fact that spring is coming and you're going to love it. And he goes on a kind of wonder walk. He goes out there and he sees the toad emerging and all these other evidence of the crocus and what have you, flora and fauna coming back to life. And what I did was I asked young people to go out and have a wonder walk in their area. And this whole COVID thing, kids being stuck indoors for hours and days on end, what have you, really got me thinking down that route. And I then did it with a year group of children that I teach at school as well. The idea of just getting out there, and I said, as a guideline, 15 minutes, and there's research about how healthy this is for all of us, young people especially, get out there, smell the fresh air, have a look around. And it was double-sided. Part of it was us, because, of course, we're thinking about Orwell's social justice, partly thinking, what can you do out there to make the world a better place? So what needs fixing where you live? But the flip side of that is, what do you want to keep? A bit like we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is it you love about your area? And so I asked all the children to take two photographs, one of each, and got some great responses. And it just felt so good, the feeling that I had got young people to go out and have a walk.
Well, I mean, that was a brilliant segue into talking about the Orwell Youth Prize, Mick, and a brilliant use, if any of you out there have had any media training, of making sure you talk about what you want to talk about on the show, whatever the question.
Let me finish.
let's go into that now then. Tell us a little bit about the Orwell Youth Prize. I was involved in helping to establish it.
Yeah.
You've been involved with it now for 5 or 6 years, maybe longer.
My sixth year, yeah.
Tell us about it and tell us, you know, how schools and how our listeners can get involved. And maybe even if they don't enter or they don't get involved or they're not teaching the right age group, or they're working in a phase where it doesn't have an appeal to primary or conceivably special, but I'm not presuming that. What can they take from it? You said that you took from it to enhance your own practice. So tell us a little bit about the Orwell Youth Prize.
Thanks, Tony. I mean, to get at it, I'd always start with the Orwell main prize, or actually prizes. And they are the country's leading prizes for political writing. Okay, so this year there are four of them: the prize for political writing, political fiction, for journalism, and the Orwell Prize for exposing Britain's social evils, which is a bit wordy, but that's life. And so, of course, that's for professional authors, and it's a terrific event. It gives you a real focus on a seriousness of intent in these different branches that really need to be acknowledged and celebrated. But of course, you can't ask young people to have the wherewithal of professional writers. So the Youth Prize, especially operating through teachers, who are the main channels for getting this out to young people, invites individual young people to write either 1,000 or 1,500 words, according to your age, on basically something to do with social justice. One of the things that makes it exciting is that young people can write in any form they want. So we get great entries as drama, we get poetry, we get journalism, we get the essay. and we get short stories and what have you. It's just a wonderful range. We've got an army of volunteers who look at first drafts. This year, the deadline has passed for first drafts to get looked at and feedback on, but that's the second thing that I find really exciting about it. The deadline this year is the 4th of June. The theme changes yearly. This year, it's a new direction, starting small. And the reason we've gone for that is partly to do with the tendency of young people to be very abstract. So if you say to them, you know, there are these big social issues we want you to think and write about, they can be very abstract and be wanting to change the world by some sort of huge global alterations, where really, you know, that maxim about writers starting with what you know, we really need to kind of embrace that. So we want that idea of starting small. And so the Wonder Walk came out of that, you know, the idea of going out in your area. If I look around, what could be better in my society? What could be better in my life? So in a way, we're looking for the kind of micro that addresses the macro, you know, the big things that arise from small details.
And can you, I mean, what's the scale of the entry? Who's it open to? Are there any year group constraints, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so basically it's targeted at GCSE and A level, but we allow entries from year 8 upwards. So our attitude with the younger, the sort of year 8 and year 9, we have had a winner or two actually from year 9, but it's more with those younger students, we're thinking of them as kind of trying out. So the junior prize, the junior of the youth prizes, goes up to GCSE age, year 11, and then the senior one is sixth form age. So it's 1,000 words for the younger students and 1,500 for the older. And what would normally be happening is right now we'd be preparing for our really wonderful annual event. You were there, Tony, weren't you?
Yes.
At one of the, we've done it so far always at an Oxford college. So you get to go to this beautiful setting, and the young people that turn up there for the day, they just have this sort of smashing time where they interact with national journalists and authors. They go, you know, they go to this sort of fabulous historical buildings at an Oxford college. And then we have sort of very interesting activities for them to involve themselves in. Normally a sort of on the day kind of debating matter that we get generated among the young people who are there. Unfortunately, because of COVID, we won't be doing it this year, but I'm sure we'll be back for 2022.
That's great. And what is the level of entry these days? How many do you get? And do you know anything about, you know, some of the classroom experience that you generate, even if you don't get an entry?
Yeah. So in terms of the entries, I think we got in excess of 800 last year. And a really interesting range. It was lovely to hear two of them read, or extracts from two of them read, on the Today programme on Radio 4. And the young people who'd managed to get to the final, as it were, really were a credit to schooling, to the nation and to themselves. It was wonderful to hear them. What was your other question there, Tony?
Just it was the number of entries and also the sense. Do you get any sense of, I know when I was at the Citizenship Foundation, Young Citizens, we were very aware that we had at one stage the Youth Parliament competition, the Political Journalism Project, Magistrates Mock Trial, the Bar Mock Trial. We would get many hundreds of schools entering, but we would also get quite a lot of schools who didn't necessarily enter, but used the materials or took the inspiration. Yeah. And they would contact us and say, we've done some great work on this.
Yeah, we did do a nice little Zoom meeting with a number of teachers from all around the country, from the Northeast, Dave, from the southwest and places in between. And yeah, it was really lovely to hear that colleagues were doing just what we kind of wanted. So if colleagues go to the website, it's a bit tricky to navigate because there's a lot of material there, but you will find that there are materials that you can use in school. There are PDFs, there are lesson plans and activities for teachers and students. So a colleague could actually take a lesson plan and just do it if they fancied that, adapt it as they see fit, or give young people tasks to do on their own.
And for those out there who are not just English teachers, but champions of citizenship education, as I've always been, clearly this engagement of young people writing about the political sphere is a really interesting one. Do you get a reasonable mix across? I mean, the criticism sometimes of these kind of competitions is that they attract an elite group of young people, or they attract young people from some types of school and other types of school. Are you reasonably confident that your participation base is wide, or is it not as wide as you would like?
Well, we're always aiming to widen it. And, you know, in terms of the workshops that we deliver in schools, our remit is only to go to schools which have among the greatest need. So we use the free school meals or pupil premium measure in terms of addressing that to schools. In terms of the entry, we can't legislate for which young people are the most motivated to enter it. What we can say is our interaction with teachers is focused on those schools with more needs.
That's great, and that's great to hear. Right, we're coming up to the last 7 or 8 minutes of the show. My dad, who was a great champion of education, mainly because he was self-taught, he had very little formal education, and he used to always say of chat shows like Parkinson and If I Really Show My Age, Russell Harty and folk like that, his point about those shows would be, oh, Parkinson doesn't need to do anything. He doesn't need to do anything. He always gets people on who can chat. And I hope as a listener that you'll feel that it was well worth persevering with my technological limitations this evening. And that we finally, having spent a fair bit of time talking about the wonders of tech, we're able to get Dave and Mick on board. So I'm gonna close with a kind of, by offering you both a gently but friendly curved ball, and just ask you each to tell us about your week ahead. What's in prospect? What are you looking forward to? What's going to get you out of bed this week? Maybe you're teaching, it may be other stuff, but what's your week ahead look like? Dave, you've been having some time, and you've been having your feet up a little while Mick's been talking about the Orwell Youth Prize. Let's start with you.
I'm going to start off tomorrow and tell my staff about this fantastic idea I've had called Wonder Walks. I've come up with myself. I mean, that's brutal. I love that, Mick. I'm going to be using that. I think it's a great
idea.
David,
if you Google it, there are a couple of great articles out. Yeah. There's a great Guardian one about urban walks, and there's even a really good Daily Mail article, would you believe?
Well, I'll have a look. I will do. Thank you very much. I'll pinch that idea. So a week ahead, Tuesday morning is a low point. I hope there's no governors listening, but it's a policy meeting with the governors. So and they won't mind me. It's probably a low point in their weeks, but it has to be done. And then it's a week of seriously. I'm not just saying the awe and wonder of being amongst these young people that I find fascinating, and also the staff. We're trialing a new system that's going to bring together all the evidence that we sort of assess, plan, do, review bring it all together under this electronic umbrella. So myself and the my deputy head and assistant head, we're going to try and learn this, ready to roll out next week. So if we get stuck on the technology, Tony, I won't give you a ring, don't worry. But that's a bit of excitement. That's something I'm looking forward to getting my teeth into this week. So, yeah, that's it from me. I think I'm hoping Mick's got something to match that. Match my policy meeting, Dave, on Tuesday morning.
Dave, I'm afraid I can't. I can't scale those heights. But I'm going to come to something maybe a bit mundane sounding, but absolutely at the heart of what we're doing in terms of assessment, which is at my school, we're going to be very involved in moderation this week. And we have been handed down as a profession a bit of a poison chalice this term. You know, we've been told, no, you're not doing examinations, but we'd like you to do these assessments.
Yeah.
Which turn out to be the examinations, except we're setting them and marking them. So for colleagues around the country, good luck, and don't overwork yourselves. But I am looking forward. I find moderation a really interesting process, partly for my own learning, but also the pleasure of working with colleagues, the pleasure of seeing the written work of students I don't necessarily teach myself, and really focusing on what is it we want them to get out of these assessments and how we're going to teach it better. You will know, Tony, and perhaps you too, Dave, that I'm a great believer that you try not to talk about the assessment until you absolutely have to. I'm a great believer there is a thing called English. There's a subject called English, which is a great subject, and students ought to learn to love it and do it to the best of their ability. And then later on, somewhere down the line, they're going to be assessed on how good they are at English. And if it actually coheres and makes sense, the assessment will match that experience. But I think this moderation is a reminder that we all need to keep thinking about precisely how well we know what the kids need to do to attain good levels. And we can never forget that.
Tony, are you going to tell us your week ahead? What are you looking forward to this week?
Well, my week ahead, I am looking forward to a series of focus groups for Bubble Schools. That's the sequel to Lessons from Lockdown. Thanks for facilitating that twin book plug, Dave. Available from all good booksellers. And if you can, get by it from an independent. I'm meeting, I think I said at the top of the show, I'm meeting with a group of educationalists on Wednesday from all, I think, every continent, if everybody makes it. So that's a kind of, because we're trying in the second book to, you know, to be a little bit less Anglo-centric. Informed as we are by our own experience and wary of making presumptions about other people's, but I've got that. I'm meeting with parents tomorrow evening, a group of parents. Each of these groups is about 15 people, and on Wednesday afternoon I'm meeting with secondary practitioners. And if any listeners out, and we have groups for primary practitioners, for system leaders, and so on and so on and so on. And an ed tech group we're trying to get off the ground. You could see how much I'll need their advice. But that is a shout out to every listener here. If you want to be involved in the research process, just do send me a direct mail on Twitter, probably the best way of doing it. And we'll certainly look to engage you. But I'm looking forward to the week ahead, but I suppose I'm in a privileged position of reporting on things like how those assessments are going down with teachers rather than doing them. So I should count my lucky stars there. I want to just finish by thanking Dave and Mick and all the people behind the scenes, in particular Tom Rogers, who has, you know, been sort of technologically rescuing me for several days now, even though this is the first show. So, Tom, thank you for that. Thank you to everybody who's tuned in. I'm not sure if the guests will get better than these two, but it's my job to make sure the show does.
The only way is up.
The only way is up. I've really enjoyed myself. I hope it hasn't been too tough on you. And, you know, enjoy your week. And you know, let's come back next Sunday and share it. Next week, COVID week one. And next week, I'm going to cheer you up even more by looking at the new inspection framework. It's all fun and games here. There you go. Dave, Mick, everybody listening.
Thank you, Tony.
Little jingle to see us out. Thank you all. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Good night. Bye-bye.
Cheers all.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.